I'm Francis Seeley, the chairman of Global Net 21, and for those again who don't know, we started Global Net 21 some time ago to get new audiences of people through social networks to talk about the major issues of the 21st century. And we hold lots of meetings, webinars, podcasts. We hold many meetings here in the House of Commons where MPs are very good and very keen to engage with our audiences, and that's great. What we're trying to do now is run a theme around community engagement, particularly community engagement with local communities and involving local government. And tomorrow we have a conference at the Local Government Information Unit where we look at engagement, community engagement in the digital age. But we want to start that off tonight by having a meeting where we look at the way we look at where local government is going, how it's developing. Because in this country, local government is very centralised compared with many other countries in Europe financially, particularly the Scandinavian countries. And there are very strong limits on how they can develop. But there are some interesting models beginning to develop, and we're going to talk about two of them today. Now, Steve and Heather have both come along to speak. Heather Wheeler is a Conservative member for South Derbyshire, was originally the leader of that council, and I was told by her office a local government girl through and through. And Steve is also a local government boy through and through. He's just got through a by-election recently. He was the leader of Lambeth, which was a Labour council. And Steve has been working very much on the cooperative model, which is beginning to develop not just among Labour councils, but amongst other councils as well. And Heather is obviously interested in some of the other models. The Barnett model, for example, is a contracting out model. And I know Heather has some sympathy with that model and she's going to talk about it. Though, of course, lots of Labour councils contract out as well. So there's no pure model. And we're trying to see what there is in between. Now, both of them are going to speak for 10 minutes and then we're going to take questions. They then have to go. And then Mike Hardy, who's from the Institute of Community Cohesion, though you've changed your name now, is from Coventry University, is going to talk after that, and Maxine is going to join in the discussion and lead it from here after Steve and Heather go. So that's the sort of format tonight. So you have a chance to question the MPs, you have a chance to come in discussion after that later. Finish about 8:15, give time to people to network, exchange emails, talk to each other, and hopefully make good contacts. So thank you very much for doing it. Thank you for hosting it in terms of booking the room for us. So can I ask you first if you would tell us about the cooperative model?
Sure. Thank you very much for inviting me. Good to see so many people here. And I don't recognise many of you, so I can tell you my little story about how we ended up calling it the Co-op Council model rather than what the Guardian called it, which was the John Lewis. They flagged us up as the first John Lewis Council, which was never a name that we gave to ourselves. That's a big department store, and we were a council delivering public services. But we decided to go very hard with Co-op Council when I saw somebody, a group of people, circulating an email discussion group with a subject line, "Never knowingly understood," which is the risk of when you go with another very big brand that doesn't quite capture what you're trying to do. So co-op councils is what it was. And the reason we started looking at that is it was our view that the current business model for local government is bust. It doesn't work anymore for a number of reasons, as efficiently as it should. But in particular, given the cuts that are being imposed on local government at the moment, you're seeing many councils, including the one I used to lead, Lambeth, places like Liverpool, losing 50% in cash terms of their total available budget over the four-year period of the comprehensive spending review. 50% of the money that pays for everything apart from education and housing. That's all of the other several hundred services councils deliver. With 50% of your money gone, you cannot keep providing all of the services that people want. At the same time as you're facing dramatic reductions in funding of that kind, and incidentally far bigger reductions for local government than national government has given to itself, but at the same time as that, demand for services, so the things you've got to pay for with your reduced amount of money, demand for services is going up exponentially. Adult care services for vulnerable, older and disabled people, hugely increasing demand because we have an ageing population. A good thing because people are living longer, but that means more people become frail and then need home care services and services that support them to live independently and as healthily as possible. Homelessness is going up because we've got a housing crisis, and it's councils that end up with the responsibility to house those growing numbers of people that have nowhere else to live. Poverty is growing up. That has all sorts of social implications that that manifest themselves in demands, higher demands for services, such as the need for safeguarding for vulnerable children and adults who are at risk of abuse or harm. All of that goes up at a time of economic difficulty. And demand for school places, something councils have a duty to provide, but for which the money has been cut in half because of record birth rates, the highest since the Second World War, higher than the baby boom in the 1960s. So dramatically less money, but growing need for services. Leaving aside those effects of austerity and accepting that the way that we've run public services since the Second World War has made us healthier, wealthier and better educated than ever before, the way that we deliver public services has had negative consequences as well. For instance, many services are substandard because they don't respond effectively enough to the needs that users have. And things that I used to see all the time walking around on council estates is that repairs, people were very dissatisfied because repairs weren't done effectively or on time, estates were not cleaned to the standards people wanted, the times to re-let empty properties if someone moved out was far too long, they risked being squatted or being used by people that were dealing drugs or engaging in prostitution. We've ghettoised the poor with our housing policies over the last few decades by shifting poor people into great big estates so that we haven't just got people in group together because of financial poverty, but because they see so many of their friends and neighbours not working, we've created poverty of aspiration as well, and people don't see a way out anymore. So we've locked people into this state of incapacity in some ways. And many people, deeply frustrated by their inability to influence the decisions that affect their lives. So if you're older or disabled, what care services are you going to get? Do you get to choose, or does someone sitting in an office block come and tell you what's going to happen to you? Or you live on an estate and your young person is at risk of getting involved in crime. You've got a view about what support they should be given, but all that's available is what someone else tells you is going to be offered to them. And you know it doesn't work because you can see youth crime going up on your estate. You're not happy with any of this, but you're frustrated because there's so little you can do about it. So, for both of those reasons, the need for more responsive services and the need for better value, we have to find ways to do different for less if we don't want to just salami slice services away until there's almost nothing left other than for those in extreme need and in extreme states of desperation. There are ways that we can do things differently. And they're not innovative of themselves. They often exist and have existed for many years in different parts of the country, in councils, in third sector organisations, in community groups. What's innovative is looking to make those kind of changes across all of the services that a council delivers at once. So, for instance, cooperative housing, which gives people living in the housing much more control and a bigger say over where they live. In Sweden, 18% or thereabouts of housing is cooperative. In Germany and Canada, about 10%. In the United Kingdom, it's 0.6%. So we have almost none compared to other countries. And yet, it allows the people that are living in that housing to have much more control over the services that run for them, because they make up the board that appoints the manager who runs all of the services that they're using. So if they don't like the services they're getting, they can get rid of the management and bring in people that will do it better. It also gives you the opportunity, if you're living in cooperative housing, to build up over time, bit by bit, and it might be only a small percentage, but some equity in the place where you're living. So you have some financial asset in the place where you live, without being sucked into subprime lending or taking on the burden of a mortgage that at some point in the future, because you're on a low income, you can no longer afford to repay, that sees you and your family thrown out onto the street, adding to the numbers that are homeless. So a progressive and responsible answer, I think, to right to buy. And it removes that corrosive and artificial tenant-leaseholder divide that means that we've split some of our poorest communities into two because they see their interests as different when actually they're all part of the same community. So cooperative housing we could see more of. Older as personalised support, or are currently personalising support to get unemployed people back to work. So instead of going along and being told you've got to go on this CV writing course and another CV writing course and another CV writing course, none of which gets you into a job, they sit down with you, work out the value of the support that they would have given you anyway by putting you on things that don't work, and then they let you choose how you'd rather spend that money instead. And they've done things like train people up to be plumbers, get them a bag of tools, or even buy them a van so they can go out and be entrepreneurial and start earning some money. Or adult care budgets, a lot of that has been personalised already, but if you pool those budgets together so that people have collectively got a bigger amount of money, you can dictate change in the provider side of the market and make change happen much faster, and you're much more likely to get the kind of services that you want to see. And organisations like Turning Point, one of the country's biggest third sector charities, do things like that. Now, in all of those cases, people get services that are better and do different things because they're run in the interests of the people that use the services rather than on the say-so of the people who provide the services. So what we're trying to do is shift power from the provider of services to the user of services in order to get better outcomes for them, even though that may mean radically different services to what were being provided before. And the really interesting thing in pursuing this agenda, and it's what the 21 Labour councils that are in the Co-op Councils Network are now looking at, is what will be the cumulative effect of giving people back control over their lives, especially the most marginalised and the most vulnerable or excluded, who have had that power over years or even generations sometimes taken away from them. And what we're starting to see in the early pilots from this is that people move away from dependency on the decisions of others to much greater self-reliance, which leads to them feeling able to aspire to bigger and better things in their life because they can suddenly see that they can get out of the hole that they've been locked into. You get more responsive services doing more of the things that people want and less of the things that people don't want. And you not only get better value for the decreasing amount of money that's going in, but you get much better social value as well, because the relationships between public service providers and the people that use them and between people living together in the same community totally changes, because we learn to value what those people have got to offer rather than just treating them as the passive recipients of services that are designed and decided on by people who do not live the same life that they do. Now, you push that across a whole council and you end up with a totally different model of what local government can be. It's very revolutionary. It involves a total change in the decision-making structures of local government, a total different change in the relationship between citizens and their local authority. But as an idea, I think we're starting to see enough evidence now to be able to say that it can transform government at the local level by doing something that, for me, progressive politics has always been about, and that's handing more power to the people.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so... So that's a very lucid description of the cooperative model. And Heather, would you like to tell us about the model that you've been working towards?
Right. My background is that I started off in Wandsworth Council as a councillor at the age of 22. And it was during Thatcher's time, and basically it was the beginnings of paring down the council to being the bare bones of what you run in-house. And there we are, there's the bell. So we've got to go and vote, but it only takes us about 4 minutes to go and vote and come back. So we will do that, we will come back, and please excuse us, and we will carry on the story of Thatcher and that marvellous stuff.
And this is not our attempt to sabotage a Thatcher speech, OK? While we're waiting, I mean, would you like to start saying some words? I mean, this is going to be play it by ear as the division bell goes, so would you like to sort of respond to what Steve says, and when Heather comes back, we may stop you and you do your bit in two parts.
So, I think it's a brilliant turnout. Can I just congratulate you, first of all, while the bells ring? Probably won't stop. I'm Mike Hardy. I'm a professor of intercultural relations. I'm the director of what used to be the Institute of Community Cohesion, but we've transformed that now, and I now lead a research centre called the Centre for Social Relations. and it does relate to the main message I'm going to share this evening. I was really interested in the co-op model, and sometimes the best way of testing how...
Speak a little louder.
It goes three times, so maybe if you speak a bit louder.
Shall I just talk between the bells?
Yeah. Other sign language. Jeff.
So, what's interesting about models and business models and alternative ways of solving or improving relations is when they work and when they don't work. So when you get a presentation of a model like the co-op model, it's rare that the proponents will say, when is it less likely to be successful? When doesn't it work? So I shall say a little bit about that later. And I don't want to anticipate what Heather's got to say. It would be most unfair. But let me focus on the things that issue the issues that are really of interest to me. It's not just about focusing on the relationship between service providers and service users, whether they're partners or customers. It's actually about the dynamics of place that interest me. Most of the places that we're talking about, and we can easily generalize and forget, are places where people live together, sometimes struggle together, sometimes they prosper together. And what we know from the 2011 census is that these places are transforming very dynamically and very significantly. So how are they transforming? They're transforming away from very simple relations and socioeconomic structural relationships to ones which are quite sophisticated and quite complicated in a world that's becoming, as we all know, although this audience doesn't reflect that, super diverse. The result of global processes and global change, and we're leading to places where neighbours are changing very radically and in quite scary ways, and where we're having to cope with a level of diversity that previous generations didn't. Now, it's the context to me matters greatly. So how you solve the issue of relating the services that you provide as a local government to the services you need as a local resident are hugely important, but cannot be determined, in my judgment, without reference, direct reference, to the dynamic processes at work on a continuing basis in those neighbourhoods. In the 2011 census, what's the fastest moving change in UK demographics when it comes to the constituency of service users in local authorities? It's the growth of dual heritage families, mixed marriages. That's a huge and significant change in the 10 years since the last census. Now, it's through the lens of that that reality in contemporary UK local authorities that I look at the models that are discussed, whether they're contracting out, whether they're cooperative, or whether they're some of the more traditional ones. What models, in other words, are able to cope and keep up with the changing nature of needs and the changing relationships between citizens and governments in contemporary Britain? And that's changing far more quickly than piloting and experimenting with different ways of remaining a relevant and effective service provider. I was going to say four things in my 10 minutes, and I've rambled a little bit. I was going to look at the real issues, the sort of judgments that we'd make as an academic, and I don't apologise for that. I look for evidence at the business model that might underpin the relationship between service providers and service users in contemporary Britain. I was then going to go on and look at the change and the dynamics that I think are changing the rules and changing the relationships, and meaning that it's very hard for us to generalise in the way that we'd like to. It leads me very clearly to write about there being no one golden rule. There is no one way of resolving and solving this dilemma of austerity and rising needs, as Steve was pointing out. I wanted then to talk about vulnerability, because one of the best lenses through which to look at the effectiveness of local government is its impact on the vulnerable. Because my passion is that it's the vulnerable that needs services most. And they're the ones through whose lenses you could be most judgmental and most objective about the effectiveness of service provision. And I was going to finish by looking at sort of models we're using now in our community engagement work. It's quite an interesting anecdote. Why we changed the name from Community Cohesion as an Institute to Social Relations is because I think we were looking for a process, a journey, which was more likely to reach some of the conclusions that we observed. We think that community cohesion is rather top-down. We think also it reflects an age where we think we can look back to some nostalgic era where communities were okay, and that contemporary change has forced all sorts of uncomfortable relationships. So I think the value that we can add from the academic world is to shed more light on what drives relationships, what makes them successful. Why is it that some relationships lead to trauma, conflict and riots, and other relationships don't? So exploring that is more likely to lead to an ability to draw conclusions about the business model.
Well, Heather is on her way. What we could do, take advantage of the fact that Steve's here and Heather's coming. Is there a question for Steve while we're waiting for Heather?
I've disposed of her.
You have disposed of her, have you? Or she went in the wrong lobby.
I don't know.
You don't know. Is there a question for Steve about the cooperative model while we're waiting for Heather? I'm sure someone has one. The lady back there, yeah. Holly, isn't it?
How do you, obviously, you're changing the balance between an authority and its relationship with taxpayers, really.
Yeah.
How do you support the behaviour change? Because obviously you've had a reliance on taxpayers and you being the provider.
Yep.
And now suddenly, you know, they're providing for themselves with your support.
Yeah. Well, they're not providing for themselves is the core of the answer to that. Because it's not about replacing professionals with volunteers or expecting people to volunteer to do things that the state can no longer afford to do. It's making the professionals that you employ accountable directly to the people they serve rather than accountable to other professionals or to politicians. So the individual citizen should see little more than their services improving as a result, and doing more of what they, as the user of the service, wished the service did, instead of what's convenient for the people who are providing the service. So you end up getting better value that way, and you're taking advantage of the insights the people in the community may have. And there may also be resources in the community that you can access as well. So, for instance, Lambeth's setting up a youth services trust, and there will be some people in the community that want to get involved in running sports teams and maybe given a bit of money for that. So you're putting money into the community and harnessing the ability of people who would otherwise not have been doing anything. But it's not about deprofessionalisation, it's about responsiveness.
OK, but go back to him now, because the structure of this meeting is getting chaotic and fun.
Yeah, sorry about that.
It's over to you now.
OK, so the background really gave me a good grounding in effect, for the want of a better phrase, a really pared down council. You provided the services by statute that you had to provide, and then politically you provided the services that your voters, who in our case voted Conservative, wanted you to provide. And if there wasn't a clamour for those services on top of the statutory ones, you just didn't do them. Simple as that. The interesting thing with that is that Wandsworth and Westminster vie for the lowest council tax in the whole of the country year on year, and 1 year Wandsworth council tax was zero. You know, something we dream of. We always provided top quality services, and we did it at a price we could afford because we didn't provide anything over on top. Now, that was a long time ago. That was 82 to 86. And then I saw the light, got married to a brewery director and moved to the Midlands. So, you know, it was a different world. And
so sorry.
That's all right. There'll be another vote in a minute, don't worry. and so up in the Midlands, completely different world. It's 14, leave school, you go down the mine, or you go to the China pottery factory. That's what you do. The girls went to the factory and the boys went down the mine. So I got on the council in opposition, and we used to have our council meetings at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because the lads at the mine would finish at the mine at 2, go in the bathhead, and then come to the council meeting nice and clean for 3 o'clock. And that's what tradition was up our end. I mean, we genuinely had clog dancing in our high street. I mean, it was a different world, a different world. So fascinating times. And what I got used to was seeing services that were run because they'd always been run, and services that were run exactly as my friend has said, my colleague, for, in effect, the value, the benefit of the council, not for the people. It was just run because that's how we'd always done it. And, you know, I had 13 years in opposition there, and I mean, my blood pressure shot to bits anyway, but my goodness me, that really gave me some worries. Because it was like trying to turn this huge, great, big oil tank around when you're in opposition. So you couldn't get any of our Labour friends to understand what the problem was. And certainly, out in Styx, the villages got next to no services whatsoever. Everything was ploughed into the town centre. Everything was in the town centre. There wasn't a leisure centre outside of the town centre. There wasn't a library, a proper library, outside of the town centre. There were, I mean, it just went on and, you know, there weren't loos outside the town centre. I mean, it just went on and on and on, because they didn't need to, because the votes were in the town centre, they looked after their blokes, they did it how they'd always done it, and that was that. So I'm afraid I sort of slightly shook things up a bit, and eventually it changed, and it became a Conservative Council, and I became the leader of the Conservative Council. And so we had a real look at what we did and why we did things. Plus, we were seeing the writing on the wall that there is no more money. Our council has reduced its government grant by 28% over 4 years, something like that. And we have not had a single compulsory redundancy. We have, rather unusually, are still council house stock retained, and we are the best council house stock retained in the country. We always had peer reviews. We asked people from all over the country to come in and look at what we did in leisure and, you know, give us marks out of 10, what can we improve, what otherwise. We were always challenging the officers. As councillors, we were always challenging the officers and saying, you've got a number of things that you've got to deliver. Value for money, quality services, services that the punters want, and a pride in the place. I mean, our levels of job satisfaction amongst our workers, incredibly high. There's a wonderful awards thing that I think it's the Sunday Times does, and it's the 200 best public sector places to work. We were 78th. Little South Derbyshire was 78th in the whole of the country. And I was really proud of that. Basically, what I should have said, but made it sound better, we were in the top 100. That's because I think you're thinking 78 is crap. But no, honestly, being in the top 100 was really, really good. And I mean, it just, our people want to work there. And they are driven by providing quality services. We've embraced all sorts of things. And again, reading the writing on the wall, there is no more money. We do so much with partnerships. Our school sports partnership is fabulous. I mean, it's run by my district council. It's not run by the county council, who are responsible for education, but it's run by the district council because we do the leisure stuff. That's what we do really, really well. And bizarrely, it's a discretionary spend. It's not, we don't have to do it. You don't have to have a swimming pool in your council area. You don't have to have a sports area or whatever. So we've talked to our public. They like all that. As it happens these days now, with health and well-being, it is becoming more of an issue. We do have... sorry, am I rabbiting on? I apologise. I'll finish on this one then. You know, we do now have statutory requirements for helping people stop smoking, helping people lead fitter lives and things like that. But we've absolutely done it in the model where we do it in partnership. So the Derbyshire School Sports Partnership is just going great guns. We were going to run out of money, so we just got all the head teachers in a room, 36 of you, right, £3,000 each of you, thank you very much, that's £100,000. Do you know what? We've got enough money. You know, it really is rocket science. So we don't get out there and moan and bitch, we just get on with it.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've got about 15, 20 minutes before they have to go. So would you like to ask some questions now, and then we'll bring Mike back in later? So okay. I know there were some hands up. This gentleman here.
This question for Steve. I'm aware that you used to be a leader of Labrick Council, yeah. And they managed to keep open every single library, as well. I think even building a new one and a new leisure centre as well.
Yeah.
Despite, I think you said, I think that the biggest reduces in cash terms of any sort of London borough. Is it down to the Cockton model that you are able to do this? Maybe use libraries as an example to explain how the cooperative model could work in doing that.
Can I ask you perhaps both to answer that, how the cooperative model does that and whether your model could do that as well?
Yeah, well, partly it was co-op and partly it wasn't. One of the benefits of Lambeth, and it's just across the river there, in central London, it's got high land values. Yeah. So what we did there was take advantage of the land values to extract value and use that to fund public services that we could no longer afford. So while other councils were closing libraries, I think Lambeth had 11, Lambeth kept all of the libraries open and built a brand new one, but at no cost to the public purse, because we built housing on top of it, and that housing funded the library. And three leisure centres, actually. One's already opened last year, another will open at the end of this year, and another one next year, all of them with a swimming pool, one of them with an ice rink. You know, it's quite dramatic regeneration to be able to do, but it's been derived largely from partnerships and delivering land values. What we did with the libraries, because the issue there wasn't the building of those facilities, with the libraries, how do you keep funding 11 of them to keep running when you've lost half your money? And libraries are in that part of the budget that the money's vanished from. So what the council's doing is building a community trust around each library, and that is being developed so that it's representative of the whole community. It's not just going to be white middle-class professional people. The trusts are going to be built in such a way that they have to have representation from the whole community that's living in the catchment area to use them. They will take ownership of those buildings and the service as they develop the capacity to do it, so there's no dumping things on the community that they don't have the capacity to run, and that means they're going to go at different speeds. Some will transfer before others. But what the council will keep doing is the council will fund services that will be run out of those libraries. We're not expecting the community to run them. That's always struck me as a daft thing to do. If the council says we can no longer afford with our professional librarians to run a library for this budget, then why would the people in the community that have never run a library be able to do it for half that budget? It makes no sense. So what the council is doing is running services like you'll be able to go in there and pay your council tax, or go and get parking tickets, or go and find out about other services. And we're retraining the librarians as customer service agents, so they're installing self-checkout machines for the books. And because those extra services are being run through the libraries, that gives them a revenue stream that keeps them going. And then the community trust around it can innovate in whatever ways they like to do other things with those buildings as well as retaining the library service, because it's now funded because the additional services help to subsidise it. So that's how it's worked.
Can we bring Heather in there as well? Because community trust may not be that far away from the concept of a community social enterprise, which you may find that you have similarities and not differences that people think you have.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And also, to be honest, we're going to sound like two peas from a pod, because, uh-oh, and I apologise, because...
That's not to be quoted.
No, do it more harm than me. We haven't shut a single library. We've opened two new Sure Start centres. I mean, you know, if you just read any of the stupid newspapers out there, you wouldn't know that, would you? It's bizarre, totally bizarre. I mean, I just... Well, that's what we've done. But also, I'll move this on. I'm trying to be a bit more positive. But on the social enterprise thing, interestingly, we've physically just finished building a new older people's village. And it's got everything. You know, it's got the pub, got the library, got the cinema, got the jacuzzi, got the hairdresser, just got everything in it. And it's fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
Sounds like here.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I haven't found the gym yet. Only been 2.5 years. But too much running up and down corridors. Who needs a gym? But what we have done, again, as a partnership thing, is all the sort of the social activities that go with keeping older people active and alive and alert and real quality of life. It's a social enterprise that's going to be running all the social activities. And so that has really helped drive down the costs.
OK, someone else? Lady at the back, you got in first. That was quick. Can you speak up?
Yeah. And I was wondering if you've got any specific examples of some tools that you use in Lambeth to measure the effects of the council and how you engage local people in that measure as well. Just a quick question for everyone in terms of neighbourhood planning and why you think your different approach would make neighbourhood planning more effective.
That was, I think, one of the things in the local government information unit's report, that measuring the effectiveness of cooperative councils is still an open question at the moment.
Yeah, well, they're still developing. There's a network of 21 councils that are looking at different services that they're running along different lines, most of it around empowerment. So Rochdale have mutualised their entire housing stock, about 20,000 homes. It's the biggest transfer of that kind to a mutual model of housing anywhere in the country. Newcastle are looking at a collective model for their schools, that now that they're not allowed to have a local education authority, the schools are pooling an element of their budget and re-providing the strategic services for themselves so they don't have to join national academy chains, which are looking at areas way beyond Newcastle and don't understand its particular needs as well as people living in the locality. And one that I'm familiar with, and I'll give you this as an example, is Lambeth Youth Services Trust. It's the first time that a council's looked to transfer its entire youth services into a community-owned trust. And the reason it's doing this is not to provide the standard universal youth services. It's because Lambeth's got the highest level of violent youth crime and youth gangs anywhere in the country. And the effect of that is you've got young people mostly living on some of the poorer estates in the inner urban areas who carry guns and knives and they kill each other fighting for the right to trade and sell their drugs on a particular patch. So it's got very high levels of youth homicide and youth violence, which is incredibly destructive, not just for the young people who are sucked into this, but for the community they're part of. So it was the responsibility of the council with the community to find an answer to this, because the way that we'd run youth services for the previous 20 years clearly hadn't worked well enough, because the problem was getting worse rather than getting better. Now, what we saw in running a few pilots was where you gave the community living on a particular estate more control over decision-making about what services were made available to their young people and who ran them and what they did with them, you got far better outcomes than when the council identified young people that were getting involved and then took them off and tried to push them through projects that the council thought it was good for them to go on. They went on the project, they came back and they went straight into the lifestyle they'd been on before. When we did it in the community on a particular estate itself, over a three-year period, that community got 80 young people out of gangs and got their lives back on track, which is the same number as the council with its services does across the entire borough of 300,000 people in a full year. So you've got far better outcomes and value for what went in. So what the council's done is use that pilot as the new model for all of its targeted youth services. So a £3 million budget and all of the physical assets go into the trust. The trust, using a constituency model that makes sure that all of the community is represented, elects a board. Half of the board is young people. The board takes own legal ownership of the funding and the assets. and then they work with each community, neighbourhood or estate with a problem with violent youth crime to allow them to choose the pattern of services they want. And if in years later it's not working, they can get rid of them and bring in something else instead. So you never lock them into being dependent on a top-down decision taken by someone outside their community.
Okay. Is there a question for Heather, just to be fair, so we have equal time?
Can I just quickly ask you...
Sorry?
I just wanted to ask very quickly, is the social dynamics is all fine and all the rest of it. Why mend something and keep on trying different ideas and thoughts, which clearly don't work? Why not actually just fix what you've got, tighten your belts, and actually just continue as it is for the next few years until this recession actually comes about?
Okay.
Changing, throwing money at new ideas, new thoughts, confusing the public, confusing the community around.
Okay. Okay.
I think that's possibly for both of us, because I think you're. Anyway, my answer to you is a little bit how. When I arrived in South Derbyshire, I couldn't believe. I genuinely couldn't believe. If you were a kid in your street and you had five GCSEs, you were considered the brainiest kid in the area. There was zero aspiration for sixth form, zero aspiration for university. So this thing that I got hold of, we've always done it this way, so we're going to carry on doing it always this way, whether you want it or not, that's what had to be smashed. Because people actually really do have aspiration, and people really do have horizons. And so it's actually been unbelievably challenging for our officers. It's taken them a good 10 years to really think about saying, actually, my job is to serve the public, and actually my job is to give the public the services that the public wants, not just, we've always done it this way. And so genuinely they've embraced it. The staff are really up for it, because it's given them a new lease of life. You know, none of us have had a pay rise for 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. And the difference is, when you were at Toyota, you actually had a pay cut of 10% or a pay cut of 15%. So you see what is going on in the big wide world outside, and in your cosy little 350 of you, you actually think, this has given me a real reason to get up in the morning. So, you know, it's a wonderfully communist word, smash the system, isn't it? But, you know, we did that up our end.
A red conservative, good. Do you want to take up his point as well? Because I think what he was saying is that often when you go into change, you can do change for change's sake.
Absolutely.
I tried to start off with what I said, with the problems that we had with the way that we run services now. And isn't that one I just gave about youth violence, youth homicides, a big one? You know, kids are being destroyed, and they're destroying the estate that they live on. Now, you could leave that the way it is and just let it get worse and worse, or you can say we need to change things to improve the situation. And I think we as politicians have a responsibility to work with the communities that want that change to happen, to explore how we make that happen. What politicians sometimes do, and what I think is wrong, is for us to go to that community and tell them, this is the change we're going to impose on you, because they have no ownership over it. I don't live on an estate like that. I don't know the kind of things that they experience in their daily lives and the kind of views they have about how things must change. So I saw it as my job to shift my power from me to them with safeguards, because you can't allow services to fall below a particular standard. You can't allow services to be captured by one sectional interest or faith group that might try to exclude others. You need to be able to build the capacity of the community to do things before you dump it on them, otherwise they collapse. But, you know, take that as read. If you then shift that power to the community and allow their insights and creativity and innovation to start dictating what happens to them, they will come up with far better solutions than anyone sitting in the town hall, because it's their kids that are getting killed.
I think we've got time for one more question, Heather.
Yep.
Yep, we do. Okay. You had your hand up first, I know, right at the beginning. Go ahead. Can you make it short, because they do have to go soon?
Yeah, just to follow up on that in a way, because you're both talking about serving the public as in central aspiration. And I was just thinking what the central impetus is to model this, and I just want to clarify that. One seems to be about giving power to people, and really is central on that, and the other one seems to be about reducing costs, and that will reduce the efficiency of bureaucracy is kind of central, which will lead to the
right, you've actually described it very well, because we have absolutely stripped out bureaucratic cost. But the point is, the ultimate service is a quality service. Mm. So clearly my punters, touch wood, are very happy about that. You know, we've not put the council tax up for 3 years. And as I say, we've been able just to re-manoeuvre things around. Interestingly, we haven't particularly sold land. What we have done, because we're a really fast growth area, is to use planning rules to take chunks of money off developers. In the trade, it's called a 106 agreement. Mm. And we have just taken hundreds of thousands of millions of pounds off developers. And that, in effect, is what has topped us up. What we're looking at over the horizon now is the changes with business rates. The changes will be, and I guess it's this April, thinking about it, maybe next April, new business that is attracted to your area, you keep the business rates. The council keeps the business rates. It doesn't go to the government anymore. Whereas at the minute, we don't get the business rates. It goes straight to the government. It's redistributed, but we don't keep them. So, I mean, I'm going to have a new power station. In fact, I'm probably going to have two new power stations. I mean, I'm going to have so much bloody money, I will not know what to do with it. But don't worry, I will do something wonderful with it.
Steve, reduction of cost versus quality of service, is that an oversimplification?
Well, you want to make the service as efficient as possible because there's less resource going around, so you've got to use what resources there as effectively as possible. But my view is that better management can only take you so far. You can get to a certain level with that, but you can't get beyond it. The purpose of doing these empowerment models isn't of it because of itself it's interesting to us. It's because it delivers you better outcomes. And that's what you're aiming for, better outcomes for the people that we exist to serve. And that means not just value for money, although that is critical, but it also recognises social value. So you can change the relationships between people living in the community together, as well as changing the relationships between citizens and the state by changing the structures that take the decisions that lead to the services that are being delivered. And that, for me, is a hugely and immensely powerful outcome that just doing things more efficiently alone will not give you. So I think that's a core difference between what the cooperative model is and some of the still very good things that Heather's been talking about.
OK, how much longer have you got? Because I know you're
in the
couple
minutes.
Couple of minutes, OK. Quick question, remember, 2 minutes left. This gentleman here.
Are you encouraging neighbourhood plans as a good way to engage with the community?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a real planning geek. So one of the best things about the principle of localism with the National Planning Policy Framework is neighbourhood plans. I'm a little bit lucky in that in a semi-rural area, not all of my area, but most of my area is parished. And it's so easy to have your obvious neighbourhood. Now, I think in the cities, it's more difficult. We know where our neighbourhood is, but in order to have a neighbourhood plan that is accepted by communities and local government, planning inspectorate, whatever, you know, you have to have something obviously defined. So maybe you guys should have parishes in your urban core. I think it would be absolutely brilliant if you did. So, yeah, absolutely, hugely important.
Do you want to respond to that, Steve, before
we... Yeah, I take a slightly different view of that, actually. So I think what you want to... And remember, I'm operating in a very different place. I'm thinking Brixton, not rural South Derbyshire. So it may just be that what Heather's described is perfectly suitable for an area like that. I know a different type of area. However, I think if you're... You don't want to create NIMBYism, where the people living in a particular area or the vocal minority living in a particular area are able to dictate what happens to their advantage, but perhaps not the advantage of other people. So the model that we were using in Brixton was about community-led regeneration, where you sat down with community organisations that were representative in different ways of the community, and then start from... principles that we want to get out of regenerating a place like Brixton, and it's very iconic. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it might be we want to maximise the amount of shared space, we want to retain balanced communities, both in terms of ethnic diversity, but also in terms of socio-economic
makeup. We want to focus on new business startups. We want to focus on the cultural and creative industries because that's something that is attractive, attracts people to Brixton now. Now, if you get everyone to sit down and agree what those principles are to start with, then you can start to build a neighbourhood plan or a master plan for the town centre in that case that encompasses that. And you can go through a sort of a self-validation process with the community that allows everyone to build from that starting point. And if you, I mean, if any of you know Brixton, it's transformed over recent years. It's one of the few areas in London that you can think of since the recession really hit hard that has boomed. You know, other than you know the obvious bits in Mayfair, we've got Russians and Arabs with pots of money coming in and investing. But it is quite a transformative approach to use, and allying that to the empowerment models that we're looking at with the way we deliver other public services, what I hope it will stimulate in the end is a much more active and resilient and strong community able to deal with the global challenges that all of us will have to face, not just today, but over coming decades.
Okay, I'm going to say thanks to both of you now because I know you have to go, and then Mike's will come in, but thank you for coming.
Okay.
And I know
I'm
you
sorry
have to
we
go.
Can't stay longer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure. Devil, maybe, sorry about this. I've already lost one pair of glasses today, so I'm doing really well. I'm now going to go in Lost Office Box and find them. Cheerio, team. Thank you very much. Love to meet you.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'm sorry they couldn't stay, but I think that was really worth it, and they were really interesting. And it's that, you know, I think, you know, you tried to pick out the difference between the two models, and you saw a lot of similarities as well. So it opens it up for an interesting debate. So what we're going to do is ask Mike to make his 4 points now he was about to do, and then open it up to not just questions, but your comments as well, because you may have points you want to raise. So Mike, back over to you.
Well, I think I'll change slightly and try and build on what were two very interesting presentations, and the questions were also very illuminating. And the challenge about what's the difference is quite important, I think. And I think there is a difference. And I think the difference is really centred on the purpose of the relationship between government and people. There's a very important difference that I hear between a focus on the efficiency of delivering services to a catchment area or a place, or the process of contribution that government makes to the quality of life in that place. And I think they are very important differences indeed. I think that we do have a view about the challenges of contemporary communities in terms of their diversity, their socioeconomic mixes, the challenges that are faced in all everyday life because of macroeconomic austerity or whatever. And I think I was quite alarmed to hear a celebration of a zero council tax, for example, because that would say that in an ideal world you wouldn't have a council. You need to resource, you need to invest in the things that matter to communities. And I think I look for a catalytic role of councils. And some of the good examples from Heather and some of the obvious examples from cooperative models do that. And it's about engagement, it's about how involved your communities become in self-management and roles. And these we know from evidence produce a better quality of life and greater social mobility, reduce the worst impacts of austerity-led poverty and so forth. Most of the reference to the libraries is a very good question, I think, on the libraries. Libraries are amazing examples of catalysts for community engagement. One of the most interesting books I've read in the last year or two is a book about that looked at 5 or 6 places in the world where communities, however challenged and different, however diverse and traumatized, were successful, were good places, were buzzy places, gave hope for every member. And one of them was a borough in New York, Queens, if anyone's traveled to Queens in New York. It's very interesting. And one of the reasons why it's so successful is reported to be the way it uses its libraries as places not, and as I think Steve was beginning to indicate, not as places which simply delivered efficiently and effectively a particular service, but a place that started to reflect the context in which it was operating. So Queens is known to be a place, greatest diversity in North America. It has more than 400 different ethnicities, I think, crammed together as a place of first footfall for new migrants and so forth. And the libraries reflect that. So they're the places where you go to find comfort with same and like, where you look, your tradition is reflected, and it's from that confidence you're able to move on. It's quite an interesting. The book, if you're interested, is by a guy called Mayer and his wife, who's a New York Times journalist, called Pax Ethnica. And it looks at seven places, I think, where complex communities work because of things like that. And they're very interesting. I mazed earlier, I think one of my main concerns is looking through the lens of those who are vulnerable. And I think a zero council tax doesn't really matter if you're sufficiently capable and resource-rich that you can look after your main needs. You certainly don't want then somebody to come replicating that and charging you high. But I think that local government and its relation to constructive and peaceful communities is about how they deal with vulnerability. And I think the types of vulnerability are changing on a dramatic scale, not just the ageing population that Steve referred to and the changing needs that will reflect, but the changing linguistic capabilities of communities, the changing precarious employment of communities, and the movement through communities that's happening on an increasing scale, so that people don't stay anywhere for long, as we used to. So these dynamics require a model, I think, for community engagement, which must engage with people through a bottom-up or an empowerment model of kinds. Now, much of what Heather described in South Derbyshire, and I visited, it is a remarkable place. There are many successes. But it actually reflected to me this notion of a very strong listening council that's rather benevolent because it does actually take cognizance of what's going on around. And I think that's a very important difference in modelling between a benevolent council that listens and that wants to meet the needs of its people and a council that is driven by its people, managed, and services which are user-led. And I had a sort of list of things that I was writing down in terms of discriminating types of models. But the difference between a top-down and a bottom-up, where would you go? The difference between adding value and making value, where do you go there? An increasingly important role of local government is to make sense of the context in which they're operating. Nobody else has the rarefied opportunity. Steve talked about the responsibility of politicians, which I liked, that you've got to actually make sense of where you're managing, where you're involving. And individuals find that much more difficult than people in places of authority or control. And then the two final points is keeping up. I think local government struggles by itself to keep up with the nature of contemporary communities. And I think any model that wants to keep up has to engage people directly in decision-making, because people are changing and their needs are changing faster than any effective or efficient structure can change to keep up. And finally, it's about the purpose and role of the relationship. Is it just about doing your statutory requirements as effectively, as efficiently as possible? Or is it about creating social capital which will influence the quality of life in the communities? That's quite a high order role. And I think I leave you with my own view. From most of my research work is from outside the UK, so I find it intriguing. I learn a great deal by working with people like Francis and groups. But there are three characteristics, three important principles that I've found are quite important in successful business models of local community management. The first is, have you got a model which allows us to respect all the different groups in the community, that promotes respect for all the different groups? Secondly, have we got a model that facilitates positive relationships between those groups? Not only respect, have you got a working way of delivering and conceiving public services that actually encourages positive relationships between parts of the community? Have you got older people helping with the development of your youth crime problems? Have you got young people helping old people with their shopping? So all those things. There's long lists. But you'd seek to look for examples of positive relationships. And finally, have you got within your community a commitment to a common good? Have you got any forum in which people are sitting down and saying, actually, we'd all be better off if that happened? So let's work towards it. Now, you have to actually pay some money and you vote, don't you? But the 21 councils that are working on the cooperative model are more likely to meet Mike's three criteria than those who are chasing cost efficiency or contracting out. That would be my personal and private view. I'm not a politician. But I set for planning, for neighbourhoods plans, which I am a believer in plans, but only if you focus on the plan on where you want to go, as opposed to focusing in the plan is how you're going to get there. If you're not aspirational with your plan, but a plan is simply a map which tells you how to go somewhere, and it's not very useful.
Okay, that's great. Okay, this is a point now where you come in and ask questions, make comments. Maxine's joining us here. Maxine's been involved in community engagement for a long time, working with communities, local government, police commissioners, worked for the Home Office as well. So I ask her, because I knew the MPs were going early, to join us and to join in the discussion from here. So please, this is a free-for-all. Well, it's not, because I'm going to be the benevolent model that Mike talked about in trying to make sure it works well. So please, who wants to start? Who hasn't spoken yet? So let's take you and then you. Okay?
I'm sure, you know, there's an obvious
list,
but I just wondered if you could go through just some of the pros and cons that are most important in your mind between the council themselves getting directly involved in doing things in the community, and not contracting out, but in a way, well, I suppose it is contracting out to charities to do the work. So, for example, I know of one, I can't remember what it's actually now, but the Wandsworth, where there's a women's charity who works with single mothers and trying to get them out of the habit of deficiency and so on. So, yeah, just pros and cons of where you think the council should be doing things and where it's busy for
the charities
to get involved.
Okay.
I respect
the
split between urban areas like Lambeth and South
Gloucester.
Okay, I'm going to take another person.
Well, I live in the London Borough of Barnet, which I think has just been challenged today about contracting out there. And one of the things which I'm aware of it is the controversy over parking, for example, in Barnet. And so I think that from what I see from that represents a very top-down one to say this is what we're going to do. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that and whether you think it might be more successful if you get people involved in the decision-making rather than imposing it.
Okay, and you wanted to speak as well, and then Julian, and then we'll go to some questions. You don't have to vote, do you? No. Okay. Go ahead. No, yeah. You may have to shout to get over the bell.
It's a shame the person from Lambeth wasn't here, because I've got direct experience of cooperative working in Lambeth on the provision of housing. Many, many years ago, there was a crisis of housing with lots of empty properties, etc., etc. We took them over, by the way, of squatting, by the way, and formed a housing cooperative. And then jointly with Lambeth Council, we took possession of all these properties on Railton and Mail Road and Poets Roads, rehabilitated them with central government funding and joint working with the council. And all the housing was given to people who are normally marginalised in provision of housing, like the LGBT community, ethnicity, disability, and all the housing was developed to the person's specification or the tenant's specification in conjunction with local community architects based at the housing associations. This is still going. It has... given a huge uplift to an area which was totally run down. Problems started with it when we were told we had very good rent collection, our arrears were very small, and they decided to impose a central body, a large housing co-op, which caused economic havoc. By having a centralised top-down management, it caused economic havoc. So it's very dangerous. It's a cooperative again, but it's a shame Lambeth learned that, because we did joint working over many, many, many years on this, and it was a huge success. We had our own central heating systems, designed communal gardens and all sorts of things. And on, I'm in working in North London at a vice providers project, and we've got loads of cuts of social services and law, etc. We're attempting to get the local community through Mackenzie Friends, etc., to be able to represent themselves in courts with their assistance. And we're trying to engage the council to fund this because it would be in the best interests of their service users if that were the case, because they'd be less likely to have severe social consequences through evictions, etc. So the cooperative thing is excellent.
Okay, Julian, do you want to make your point, then we'll get some responses.
Just briefly, thank you very much. The essence of what I picked up is that innovation seems to work, but there's a challenge of proving efficacy. So there's been the cooperative model, and there was a mention of where it succeeded, and there's also questions of where it hasn't. So how is it that what I'm most interested in as someone who's setting up a social enterprise and looking to influence and positively contribute to government contributions, how is it that we can look at where there are models that have been proven successful? What is the requirement for efficacy? How do we, if I have a model that I think works, what is the stage that I need to get it to that proves its viability, that then can be at such a degree that we can actually say, hey, look, this works, and then gather contribution and support around it within government? I'm that's what I'm curious about.
Okay, do you want to take those? Because I think three major points came out of that from the speeches. One is what is the difference between the two models? You were asked for a point by point difference, which may be difficult to do, but what are the major differences? The other point that came up is that, if you have the cooperative model, then you have real problems if you don't provide advocacy and support, and the cooperative model could easily fail and you could go back to a top down one. And the final point, I think, was how you move on from that advocacy and how you can move on from that support and measure the efficiency. And how do you then do that in those models so that you can replicate and make them successful? So Maxine and then Mark.
Okay. I mean, a worry for me with this whole principle anyway, and even with both models, is that I think we've come from a time where we look back 2 or 3 years where we created in communities a massive dependency culture by doing for communities all over the place. And so people got reliant on being done for. And I know from personal experience when the cuts first started to hit with communities that people would say, what's going to happen to my women's group? We've been there for the last 10 years. Well, what do you do? Well, we sit around and we discuss. But nobody had ever taught them to do that themselves, and that was a role that people within that group could take on. They didn't need a worker. But I think the other side of that in this brave new world is that the first things that went under the cuts were generally youth and community support, community development. I don't know about in London, but I know certainly in the north of England is pretty much non-existent. And yet we're talking about models, and both models referred to this ability to consult communities. And yet, who is going to be around to do that really in-depth consultation, especially for the cooperative model, without those really strong community development structures? So I think, for me, that felt a real concern. I don't know if anybody else has noticed that. And I also worry that with these models, and it's almost having 20 years of working across local authorities, it's very easy to then do a model, it gets a bit stale, pull the plug, the communities are then left suddenly not as empowered as they were told they were. And I think, you know, I worked for about 6 years in a New Deal for Community area, which is very similar to a cooperative model. It's an area where, you know, £50 million was given to the community. But the community was still very much controlled in that spending. You take, you know, ordinary members of a very poor estate, and that's the money was given to them. And they would sit in meetings, and they'd come in with paperwork like this. And I worry as well about communication and who is being pitched to. Because I know it was interesting when listening to the MP saying about Rochdale and the housing. I live in Rochdale. I don't even know it's changed. Where is that information? And I think that very often when we communicate with councils, council officers are the world's worst for communicating at a certain level, and that's at the level they are at. And therefore, all the other people underneath don't even know what's going on. So I think with both models, I worry about how much the communities really know, how much is the usual suspects ruling the roost, and actually how long before models get dull and boring and the plug is pulled and the communities end up again feeling what was in that for us. So I think I feel a bit cynical about both models, because without that control, then how does the community ever get hold of anything really? And whether it's top down or bottom up, people change, plans change, councils change, governments change, and things change.
Okay, do you want to take up that for Mike and deal with the question of support and measurement?
Just a quick note on the difference. I think the difference is huge. Ever since when I was a young lad, I used to study history, and I used to like the social history of the 19th century. That's when we started doing things to people, and we've continued doing things to people ever since. When the rich found out that cholera didn't choose just to kill poor people, then they brought in public health. I mean, in the 1870s. So I think part of the difference between the co-op model and the other model is this commitment to changing that paradigm. Innovation does work, and we shouldn't be frightened of using it. So the difference, the co-op model is a new model, which, if it works well, and if it's adhered to in terms of the principles, empowers people to be self-managers in their community. And that is a big change. Now, I think it's hugely difficult, so there are problems with it. And the main problem is that you judge your cooperative movement by the power and qualities of our democratic governance system. So it requires you to have representative governments. But I don't think democracy is shown to be working very well. So we don't really have a better solution, so we run along with imperfect systems. What has been the main problem under New Labour of community engagement was that we engaged with community leaders, and we did it really well. But we didn't check if the leaders were actually representative leaders or whether they were talking in turn to their constituents. So these are imperfect structures, but innovation's important. What this final point is, can we generalise? Can we take something that works from our innovation and then multiply it all over the place, or take it somewhere else?
That's what I said. Okay.
It's good, because I don't think we can. No. I think the essence of getting this right is being extremely local and extremely contextual. I'm not a great fan of localism because it's abused and used differently, I think, in the UK, but I am in favour of locality.
Okay, Alicia.
Yeah, just coming back actually to answer your question, because I'm actually doing what you are interested in. I work for the New Economics Foundation, and I'm actually implementing a new model, or rather trying to get councils to implement a new model to do with social housing. And what you need to do is you need to find somebody who will champion it. So you need to sell it, and you need to, I mean, you know, I can't tell you how many local councils I've spoken to. You need to find somebody who will implement a pilot study. And when you've got that person, that's because you can't prove it works until you can prove it works, you know. I mean, you can't prove it works until it actually works. So you've got to have somebody who will take that leap of trust and give it a go. But there is quite a lot of enthusiasm for trying new things because the paradigm has changed so much. So I think it's actually quite a good time to try stuff. I know that we don't have a lot of money around, but precisely because of that, a lot of people do accept that we can't carry on doing the same old things the same old way because there just either isn't money or it just doesn't work. So I think that's what you need to do. You need to find somebody who's prepared to follow through with it and give it a go and make sure that you have all the right measurement systems in place from the start, because you don't want to be trying to sort of go, oh, damn, we didn't ask them that question at the beginning and now we can't compare. So you need to make sure that your measurement is in place right from the word go.
OK, and the gentleman hiding behind Sadie.
There you are.
This is a really interesting debate. It's something that, you know, I've got more and more into because I'm the volunteer support coordinator in my local library, and I really do see the role of libraries as being pivotal, you know, the community. It could be when you go to a new town in another area, you go straight to the information centre and they point you out, this is happening, that's happening, you know, and the librarians and libraries could do that on a global level. They could say, we're not just a store of books. But a lot of debates and government organisations and stuff are here, they're there, this is how you can learn about how the education system's working, you know, inform parents and say, look, there's the tools, this is how you can use it. You can use it in so many different ways for people to come together. We've got several rooms in the library and we rent them out and there's just so many community groups coming forward and they love it. It's just, you know, they rent it really cheap and they feel like they're giving something to the community. And we have like 60 or 70 volunteers. They do 4 hours every 2 weeks, and we've got a list of people on reserve. But the point I was going to say is new paradigms is exactly the word, because the one thing that I think has troubled us in the past is we didn't have the global communication platforms that we do now. This is a turning point in the history of our, you know, humanity. We can communicate, you know, we can get out of this city and town bubbles and actually collaborate with ideas. You know, and I see, you know, if something in society is not built based on laws of nature or as close as to that, it will collapse, it's not sustainable. And like, for example, I create this, you know, metaphor to a tree. You know, every leaf goes through the process of photosynthesis to try and capture life, you know, turn it into, you know, the sort of glucose and everything and bring it back to the stem of the tree. And the stem then uses that to grow the tree as a whole, you know, and it doesn't discriminate between the leaves. The leaves do their individual role, whether the sun shines more from the south, more from this side and that side. And I think the way we communicate in society and harness our knowledge, which is the impulses and electricity, again, like in the leaf, you know, could do that for us. And now what we can work on is the platform. You know, the platform where you show people in real life what's happening around them. So instead of all this Facebook and Twitter and stuff, you know, people venting their frustration and they're creating a storm and it just evaporates and nothing happens. Maybe a social platform where people tap into it and they can see projects going on and it's on a local, national, global level. Because something like that could really make the job of politicians redundant. You know, if people's minds will just open up and they'll see what's happening, and you can hold politicians and local government accountable. This is what people want done with their local schools. There's them voting on the different solutions live without a general election every 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. What have you done?
Okay, Peter and then Jeff.
Okay, agreeing with our librarian enthusiast there, fantastic resource. But coming back to what you were saying about bottom-up development, there's another layer that everyone ignores in all these models, and that's the willingness of some of the older people to mentor into the younger generation. There's a very interesting program by George Clark, just started last night, where they're rebuilding old houses, coming back to your one, by taking youngsters off the street that were almost in the gang culture, and showing them another alternative. Maybe you saw it, the proven program from Channel 4, so it'll be on their iPlayer. It's that layer, that mentorship layer, nobody talks about it in the modelling side, which I think is important.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think there's a real danger that it becomes an interesting middle-class intellectual debate about, you know, models and things like that, which actually, if you are genuinely a believer in pushing power downwards or pushing power out to communities, the last thing you want to do is to get into a virtualizing area. What you need to, the first step is to actually have those who hold the power willing to do it, willing to actually give it up. Secondly, they've got another responsibility, and that is to provide mentoring and help so that the people who, if you like, who are the recipients of the service, whatever the service is, whether it's housing, libraries or whatever, actually then are given the ability to take control of it and run it in the way that they want to run it. Because at the moment, there's a real danger that what actually happens is you create just another new power structure where, you know, a different kind of person becomes the government, in inverted commas, with small and big G. You don't get rid of politicians. Politicians will always re-emerge, and they'll always be there waiting for somebody to knock them down.
Okay, I mean, two points there. One is the point you made, and Peter raised, you raised two points really, is that the idea of actually having an exhibit of good case studies rather than bad case studies that people can actually learn and replicate from, and maybe you could take that up. And the other point which Jeff raised, Maxine, which is a development of your point that you made earlier, and that is, you know, models are okay, but they are a bit academic, and you've got to actually get in and do it in practice. But if you don't provide the support for what you want to do, if you don't provide the mentoring, if you don't provide the backup structures, then the models are going to fail and the old power structures will come back. Do you want to take your point first?
I misunderstood your point earlier. I think the power of example is beyond all talk and intellectualising. And I agree with you entirely. I always get embarrassed when we talk about models. But this is quite an intelligent audience. You know, we're actually trying to...
Well, I'm here as well.
Exactly. I don't apologise for being an intellectual or for intellectualising. Sometimes it's important. But you need to know your place, I think. And I think the way through that is to show people to have to feel things. And so when I felt my parents' council house they bought, and they felt really good about it, and I learned a lot about self-esteem and about the way to coexist in the UK at a time of property ownership meant everything. But they couldn't sustain it when I was younger, so they lost it, and they lost it. It went to a private landlord. It was privatised, and they stayed in it, but started paying a private landlord's rent instead of a council house rent. Now, I got lucky. I got out. I went to university. I started thinking about that and trying to intellectualise that. Didn't damage my understanding. It enabled me to see that there are models of social housing and of home ownership that can be combined in a civilised place and create goodness and create a common good around. The way it was done in that era wasn't a good example, and I wouldn't point at it, but I point at good examples that I've found elsewhere. So I think examples are really powerful.
And then Maxine, taking that up, that you know, politicians, political power is always ready there to fill a vacuum if you don't provide the right support.
Yeah, well, I agree with your point, and I just wonder how much of the giving of power is still tokenism, because it's always there to take back straight away when it's either not working or it's removed. But I think I'd like to make a couple of points. We've talked about good practice, but one of the things that I think that I always like to know, and I think in some ways it's just as important, is what hasn't worked. Because we always have loads of manuals everywhere on things that have worked. We don't look at the things that went really pear-shaped. And so we keep doing them, and it's, you know, and it is that thing, isn't it, that, you know, the sign of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. But how are you going to know that we're doing it over and over again if nobody's put it in a document? So I think when you look at good practice, you know, please start to look at really what we shouldn't keep doing, because I think that's really important. And I think the library guy and his vision for the future and the world network, I think you're spot on. I think we've got to start looking to the future, and I think, you know, I mean, we're here today because of Global Net, and that's how you all know about it. But I think as well, to take on board the non-academics in the room, you know, we also need to keep things simple. And I think that, you know, showing good practice, not just putting it in reports, but, you know, like, you know, Francis is really into video blogging and showing people's life stories, and that's great. And particularly for people like power makers, decision makers, politicians, to actually see real life cases of people who talk about the things that worked or haven't worked for them in their life is far more influential than any manual, I think. And so.
Okay, I'm into video blogging, but I have to admit I'm the one guilty for putting the word model in the promo, so Jeff, you can blame me for that. But I know what you mean. Sorry, someone had their hand up. Yeah, gentleman here.
In terms of what doesn't work, come read the reports that we do at the London Assembly, because we look at what doesn't work, scrutiny across councils, looks at what doesn't work as well as what does work, to try and learn lessons from what's gone wrong. And I don't, at the risk of a lynching, like to speak up for politicians. Okay, I do work for them. But I get to vote on whether they stay in power or not. And sometimes I'm a bit suspicious about who community leaders are in terms of who appointed X, Y, or Z. In terms of the gentleman behind me talking about alternative power structures, those alternative power structures can sometimes be self-appointed leaders for whom there is no way of removing.
Can I ask you, because that's an interesting point that we're trying to raise and the things we're doing, how do you go beyond those community leaders to find out what really is happening and what is really desired in the community?
Isn't that why we have democratically elected
exactly.
politicians? Because that is their job. They are there to represent the people who voted for them. And I expect the members I vote for not to come to me and go, what is it my voters think? I expect them to come and tell me this is what my voters want.
So optimism isn't dead.
maybe that it is imperfect, but in the factual, I would refer the Honourable Gentleman to a response from her predecessor, Churchill.
Yeah, okay.
It might not work very well, but try any other system.
Any system is so far worse, yeah. Who's next? Lady over there, and then the lady in front. Two ladies. Three ladies. One, two, three. Okay, you, and you. Okay, Miss Sadie?
I suppose I'm a politician because I'm a councillor in Wandsworth, an opposition councillor, I have to say, because we have to fight many a good fight, including stopping closing our library in my patch. One of the things I think, we are talking about it a lot, but one of the hard bits is how do we get people to participate at the right levels? How do we build that capacity? And that's certainly one of the things that we struggle with. I mean, we did stop them. We had big meetings. We did stop them closing our library. And we've done various other things. But so, for instance, it's looking, and I'd like to hear from other people, about how you get other... Because you do get the usual suspects. And you do get people on committees that you think, God, why are they on it? But like at the moment, we've got there's a couple of things happening in my patch. With a regeneration thing hopefully happening, and then we've got a steering group. We went to a meeting, this steering, and there's somebody from this and somebody. There weren't anybody from the older people's forums. I said, well, that's a mistake. Why haven't we got anything? You know, they forget whole chunks of people, so you can do some intergenerational. But I think it is finding different ways of approaching people. On Saturday, last Saturday, I was at... whichever room it was, the chapel, it was the chapel. We had a coffee morning for the older people, mainly from sheltered housing groups, because it's easy to find them, and often the people who live on estates that are older, that aren't sheltered, so that they could come to a coffee morning and say, look, what do you want? So, I mean, it poured down, so one brilliant response, but it's finding, well, how can we get people engaged? That you can sit and be less formal, that won't come to meetings like this, I'm cutting L's chance. And then in the afternoon it was the mums and they all the rest of it. But it is finding ways of getting people to come along and say what they want. And even looking at what they want, a lot of this big lottery money that we're supposed to be getting is about community participation.
but it was still when you looked on the list and were putting post-its and all the rest of it. So actually, we've moved quite a long way, but it was still things rather than mentoring or rather than. So there's still so we've a lot of education on you're just as important as anybody else. Come and tell us, and that's what I'm fighting with at the moment, and just sort of seeing how we can get more people. Yeah, you know, people stop me all the time because I seem to be everywhere. Little things like that. But it is, you know, them feeling they can talk to you, whereas quite often they walk into a room and think, oh God, no, I'm not talking in front of this lot, and they just clam up. So ideas for how to get the rest of
them. Okay, this lady here.
Hi, I wanted to ask a question about communication and social value, because there's one key aspect that I feel has not really been covered to date, and I think it's financial education, because when you look at, you're talking about individuals here, no matter whether they're part of the community, based in the city or based in a rural area, the one commonality is that we all have to handle money. And the UK has one of the poorest forms of financial education. I think 90% of all adults in the UK receive no form of it, but people are expected to deal with it every single day, and it does devastate lives. You know, I think you're getting 93 homes a day being repossessed, and I think that this should be something that local councils take on board, and that local authorities and housing associations look at the way they engage with people on a daily basis and think, well, what is valuable for people? Is it a case of providing a lot of services they don't need, or looking at the things that are not being covered in the system and finding a way to provide for those? I'd like to pose a question in of how can we learn from the social enterprise system or from private businesses? How can local councils engage more with the private sector to make those things?
Are you talking about financial education to councils or financial education to people in communities?
People in communities,
okay. So there's two interesting points. Part of the parish one, which I think is interesting in itself, and it's something we should do something about hopefully in the future. But the two questions, maybe, Mike, you could take the first one, which is how do we actually find out what community wants? We've got two models, doing it through the politicians, which we could say have succeeded and failed. The other is doing it through community leaders who often aren't representative. Is there any way of going beyond that? That's the first question. The other question, which we were talking about earlier with Ian back there, is the whole question of communities and empowering them and financial education being a part of that and having advocates who can help do that. So maybe you can take the
first
one.
We have a long tradition of being top down in order to be bottom up. So we go to leaders and we find out what we can, or we run what I think is the most appalling qualitative research method, and that's the focus group. We get people in and we sit them around the table, we give them a Marks and Spencer's voucher and we ask them for reactions. And what you get is a visceral response. Most people, the psychologists will tell you what you want to hear, particularly if you give them a cup of tea. But let me be quite direct. I think there is a world full of experience of how to get direct access to people's feelings, their needs, and their full engagement. We can learn a lot from the history of development aid, participatory rural analysis that's developed, which I'm sorry it sounds technical and so forth, but it's not. We've used all sorts of methods to empower very, very vulnerable people in the world and get through to them. One of the most successful devices that's emerged in recent years has been that of the fair trade. You've all heard of it in coffee and tea. Where did that come from? It didn't come from well-meaning, good economists going and telling what you needed. It came from participatory rural analysis, people working in the field, talking to ordinary people and using new techniques, not focus groups, sometimes using graffiti and the power of graffiti to communicate, sometimes using still cameras, getting people to take pictures over a period of time and using different ways of getting. I think we've got to be really clever to get close to people's needs and not assume that our traditional methods work. And I think the last point I wanted to make, because there's been some brilliant suggestions and comments, I think accountability is a very important concept for this conversation. How can people be held accountable if they haven't the skills to manage some of the issues, your financial question? But if people move on, how can they be accountable? In the social enterprise model, you've got an ability to harness accountability because you've got a double bottom line that you can, you've got metrics and you can measure them. In the old community top-down services, you've got accountability. You've got elections every so. You can do an awful lot of damage between elections. And the problem with the cooperative model is you don't have a metric for accountability as easily applied. So it's one of its limitations. And I'm really interested in accountability because I think if you're able to hold somebody to account, then any of the power relationships that might emerge or be replaced can be challenged.
Okay, and the financial education one?
Yeah, it kind of wraps up a few things that have been said, really. But in terms of who is best and how do we consult communities, I've always believed the best people to consult, to work and engage in communities is people from that community. And I've always been a sort of an advocate, really, for the community champion role, the person who is trained up to a level where they can go out into their own community. People will speak to them because they relate to them, and they can find out information, etc. And we've been talking about, with Ian from over at Guinness over there, about looking at a model around... he's going to keep his head down, we keep pointing at him. But we've been talking about looking at using community champions and actually to look at training them to take on issues that affect their community, and that might be anxiety or crime in that area or worklessness. Or one of the things that actually we've just been speaking about is around helping with financial education, financial support. So yeah, I mean, we agree completely and are on the same page that it is important, and you know, but it's not being touched. But I also think one more point is that somebody mentioned over there before about who knows their community best, and I always say this, but the people who know their community best are the people we very rarely tap into, and that's young people. They are the people who are on the streets at night when most people have gone to bed and drawn the curtains and looked and started watching Coronation Street. They're the people who are more likely to be the victim of crime. They are the ones who are the eyes and ears of community. And by working with and engaging young people, you're getting the message home to their parents as well. So it's a double whammy. If you can get them up to gain trust and to be on your side and to be an advocate for you as professionals, then basically you're in a win-win situation, especially when they can start spreading that message wider.
Okay.
And we always forget them.
Okay, we're getting close to the end. I'm going to take one more or two more questions. I always go for people who haven't spoken yet because I want to give everyone a chance. So would you like to say something?
You mentioned the community champions, and we need to have a lot more people than this crowd to be asking questions, what is good for the society and what is good for themselves. And I was a teacher, and I find that, I was a science teacher, and I find that the natural sciences are compulsory in schools, but social sciences are not compulsory. They are not taught enough. And so I have found that students, even the so-called naughty students, they want to learn about social science, because that is their life, that is their families, how they live, how their societies work. That is what they want to know. There's a lot of research to show that they want it, and they can, it can be done. So we need to improve our education system as well.
Okay, anyone else who hasn't spoken yet, Anne?
Just going on what you're saying about where our innovation comes from and not just any focus groups. And befriending, I helped to run a community center in the prison, it's only around for a year, and it's relationship building that just takes time. And this is the problem, that politicians are there for X number of years or whatever, and by the time you've actually, you build a relationship with people and you get the information you need, your term is over, and you have your season. So people want a quick fix, so they have these focus groups. And when you're going to find information from, an after school program that goes week after week, and you start to talk to the moms, or after, a midday bridge club for senior citizens. I mean, and these are things you have to keep doing them week after week after week, and you can't have a, one off or two off focus group and expect to get real information.
Okay, I think we'll end it there so we can go into informality. It's quite nice to end from the from the floor, and I think it's a good point to end on about consistency, about having some sort of sustainability in the system, and how we do that is another question that we might take up at another time. Anyhow, thank you. It's been a really, really good turnout. I'm sorry the structure wasn't as perfect as we want, but chaos is sometimes quite innovative and fun as well, and I think it worked doing it this way, and I'm glad the MPs came, stayed as long as they could. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Maxine, for stepping in as well. And thank you all for taking part, and it's been great. But we've got time to just circulate and talk to each other, so please do that before you go. Thank you.